And hello and welcome to recording number 21 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 17th, 2021. All right, now on yesterday, we finished up talking Gord on Gord, who is now in the Plain of Cats, where the Cat Lord reigns. And he was whisked there, along with most of his companions, by a fortunate misuse of a banishment spell. It was a very heavy-handed bit of a plot device here by Gygax, which I was very... I thought was extremely unfortunate, and it even made me wonder whether this manuscript, since it came out in 87, was actually written by or edited and perhaps changed by someone else. The device was just so incredible that Gord reaches into a pouch of holding and pulls out the exact thing they need to save them. And then it turns out that he misspeaks it in such a way that it saves them in a way the banishment scroll wouldn't have, which wouldn't have worked on what they were facing. And what they were facing was Nerl, not perhaps the avatar of Nerl, but Nerl, the greater god, and should not have been allowed on Earth, according to... you know, what the previous stuff had been. And, I'm sorry, I'll have to... hold on 1 second right here. All right, I'm told that, unfortunately I had a drop-off off there. So I'll just go and repeat what I said, and if we have the chance, we can edit out the previous bit later. So what we encountered previously was that Gord and most of his companions have been moved to the Plain of Cats, which is somewhere hidden between the ethereal, astral, and primaterial planes. Now, the situation was that Melth, Chert, Biff, and Lizard had been pursued by the Hierarchs, and they had summoned up something, some black ebon cloud, that was causing terror and fear and pursuing them. And eventually they reached a point where they could not run any further, and they were going to have to confront whatever was coming at them. And then, luckily, till their rescue, Gord and Geller and Curly and Inkose, the Flan warrior, had been following, and they saw the black cloud just at the right time. Gord suddenly had this ability to see into that black cloud. And what he saw was these four being pursued by a mighty daemon from Hades and a rider on top, who... I believe Gord recognizes as Nerl, or perhaps they put the name to it later. And Nerl, of course, is a greater god, and no way of any of them being able to defeat Nerl. And unfortunately, the way it ended up being written is Gord miraculously pulls a rabbit out of his pouch. He has a pouch of holding, and it's not a rabbit. He pulls a scroll that has the exact banishment spell that might save them from a normal daemon and stuff. But, as it turns out, not only is he have that banishment spell, he misspeaks it, which we pointed out is part of, with a thief over 10th level, they have a 25% chance of miscasting a spell from a scroll. So anyway, that was actually a very handy thing to see, is Gord having difficulty and mispronounced this spell. And then, because he misspoke it, and because he has a connection to the Cat Lord, his last name that he summoned up as powers to banish who was attacking was Rexphilus, who is the Cat Lord. So when he says his spell, it turns out he didn't banish anyone, and he couldn't have banished Nerl, because it's, you know, Nerl's is so powerful. But he does get transported along with his companions in Melf and his surviving companions to the plane of the Catlord. Well, you know, unfortunately, that was a very heavy-handed bit of plot device dropped in there. Like the Greeks would say, the deus ex machina. When the characters ran into a situation they could not possibly get out of, down they would lower from heaven the hand of the gods, and they would save them. And so very much that. It's very poor writing. And I was expecting it should have been a nice knockdown, drag-out fight against a high-level cleric. The head of the Hierarchs is supposed to be an 18th-level cleric. It would have been a very, very interesting fight. Instead, we get this, a kind of Flash Gordon save at the last minute. Or, you know, and even worse, it's just, now, as the story goes, it's one of the things that is introduced is the results from this. So I just don't know. It just seems too heavy handed for the way Gygax was handling things. But anyway, that is where things were. And then, they were introduced to the Catlord, and there was some explanation that Gord had previously met him. Now, in Saga of Old City, in the previous part of this book, Gord had not met the Catlord. But there is this set of short stories called Knight Errant. And I strongly suspect that it's this reference may be fleshed out in the Knight Errant stories. Because the story of Gord finding the scroll, which he used, comes from a short story from Knight Errant with Plincourt the Vampire. And that story I'm very interested to read, but I'm not going to skip ahead. Even though the short book of short stories, Knight Errant, takes mostly place in the past of where we are now, it's still not in the publishing sequence. And I want to try to keep to that and not jump back and forth or jump ahead. So anyway, there's some story about Plincourt the Vampire. Fine. We'll get to that. I'm suspecting about Rexphalus the Catlord, there is also some story out there which will explain what Gord is referring to. So I'm going to start here on page 197. And they are in the plane of the Catlord, and they've just been introduced and such. All right, so it is paragraph 4 from the bottom. All right. Gord, with the help of the others, explained the circumstances surrounding their sudden intrusion into the sanctum sanctorum of their startled host. At the same time, Melf, a wizard and fighter of no small skill, and his lieutenant Biff, a clever little halfling skilled in swordsmanship as well as thievery, made the acquaintance of Geller, Curly Greenleaf, and the redoubtable Gord of Greyhawk, a person oft mentioned by Chert during his sojourn with Melf and Biff. Chert, already an old acquaintance of both Bard and Druid, needed no introduction. In fact, both Geller and the half-elven Druid Ranger have been regaled with many accounts of the adventures of Gord and his hulking companion, so both were well aware of the camaraderie that existed between the two young adventurers. "Lizard is not here," Melf said in consternation. "I saw him fall, dashed terribly by the monster who served the Reaper," the halfling had volunteered in reply. "What of Inkosi?" Gord had said, looking inquiringly from the one-eyed bard to the rotund druid. "Fled in spell-induced panic," recalled the bard, bald half-elf, shaking his head sadly, "when last I saw him." "Six of us, then," said Chert slowly. "Three of us and three of you, Gord," he explained, meaning that his friend's group equaled theirs. "This amounts to a most unwholesome number. Still, I think it bodes well, not ill, for us all." Then had the master cat brought them into his abode and seen to their needs. Now they were all fed, tired, and had naught but comfort and a good night's rest before them. Without further ado, the half-dozen newly met adventurers went to their own chambers to sleep the sleep of the justly fatigued. Some time later, hours, days, the time was uncertain here, Ward awakened, completely refreshed and feeling ready for anything. A feline person of indeterminate gender was standing beside the soft couch upon which he had slept for how long? Who could tell in such a timeless place as this? "Greetings, man called Gord," the cat creature said, showing a mouthful of sharp fangs as it smiled. "There is a pool which hairless ones such as you and your friends will enjoy bathing in. Thereafter, a repast awaits you in the court of dappled sunlight and pleasant stretching. Please follow me, and I will show you the way." Break. Chris is posted here that the two stories from Knight Errant are The Weird Occurrence in Odd Alley, a vampire story, and that probably has Plincourt, and it's a very interesting one. I believe it also has some plainer stuff in it. And Cats versus Rats, which involves Rex Phyllis. So yes, you know, when we get to Knight Errant, we're going to be backtracking in time a little, and we're going to read some of the events. I remember they involve Chur and Gord for quite a bit of that series of short stories. So we're going to hear a little bit of, I think, what happened at the end of Saga of Old City and before we start Artifact of Evil.
Yeah, so I guess we'll get a little bit of the backstory about how he got the scroll.
Yes, and hear about Plincourt the Vampire. Mm-hmm. I remembered liking Weird Occurrence in Odd Alley, so I am looking forward to that one. I don't really remember Cats versus Rats.
Sure, me either. I didn't read them. I just I just remembered we talked about it. I was like interested as to what they exactly were.
Yes, yes, and I'm glad to hear that it looks like we are going to get the stories of what, you know, what has happened here. And not just the little bit of, oh, they met before. So,
because right, that's a little too handy for that to happen.
Yes. Now, I'm not sure where, other than Knight Errant, I kind of think that Gygax was writing these stories during his time still at TSR, and maybe they were going to be published in Dragon Mag or something. I think that the next book, Sea of Death, is also, it's more a continuation of this story here. And then we get Knight Errant, and then we get with his new company, New Infinities, the City of Hawks, which is really a restart of everything. It's a retelling of Saga of Old City, and it is actually changes a lot of things that I think maybe some of the stuff that we've commented on that seemed a little odd or off about Saga, especially about that Cat's Eye ring. I think once Gygax has brought that to the fore, then when he gets to City of Hawks, he maybe adds a little more information about it.
Right.
So right here, we're really, I think, mostly, we're on the plane of cats here. Or the Cat Lord's plane, and here there really isn't much. I mean, there's a retelling. I'm not sure. We were already told what happened to Inkosi and Lizard, especially Inkosi, that the Cat Lord had said he wasn't transported, but maybe Chert didn't hear that. So anyway, Gord was asking what of Inkosi. But that had already been mentioned, that he wasn't brought because he had fled in terror, and he was out of the area of the spell. The other thing was this little bit about the court of dappled sunlight and pleasant stretching. So, you know, I find that, you know, that's very amusing, that the plane of the cats has the, you know, their courts are pleasant stretching in sunlight. So
as opposed to the court of unpleasant stretching, like, yeah, the rack. I thought it was great.
Yes. All right. Now there's a comment here about us doing the backstory, and yeah, you know, it's that the scroll that pops up out of nowhere actually does have. It may or may not have a backstory. I mean, they mentioned Plincourt, and they say they got the scroll there, but I haven't read it in a while. I'm not really sure that this scroll is mentioned. Now, Gord wasn't sure what it was, I believe, when we had just read it now. And so that really, you know, I don't want to keep harping on this. It just bothers me, you know, that it is so... plot device hammering over my head that I keep bringing it up, and I've talked about it, and I'm just gonna let it go and keep going forward here about how much I dislike that little bit of plot device. Oh, so in this section here, we're really not getting too much. There's a little bit about you know, here's a talking undefined feline cat creature. And then they mention the court of dappled sunlight and pleasant stretching. So we do get a little more information here. All right. Now, I'm going to restart. And it is page 198 and the third paragraph from the bottom. Gord complied happily, not even bothering to slip on the loose linen garment tossed across the foot of his downy bed. There was obviously no need, for the temperature was mild, and he was content to go as nature made him. Arriving at the deep pool, he found everyone but Curly and the mage, Melf, there before him. Chert was frolicking at a game of tag with the tiny halfling, while Geller and a striking woman with tawny hair lay basking totally nude in the warm sunlight. Gord was suddenly self-conscious and leaped into the waters to hide his nakedness. Both the bard and the woman laughed at his discomfort, and eventually he came out of the pool. No need for such concern, the lovely female said to him in a wonderfully throaty voice. Save for you and your friends here, we are all cats of one sort or another. None of us cares a whisker for the conventions you humans choose to affect. Right, so, again, Gord, his sudden bashfulness is again, I think, a real sign that Gord still hasn't really changed all that much from his awkwardness and naivete that he seems to continually have around women. And so he's fine walking naked out to the pool until he sees, you know, the tawny, beautiful woman, and then suddenly he's self-conscious. All right. Now let's see. And as she explains, naturally, the plane of the cat lord here is definitely for all cats. So they don't have any, you know, concerns of human culture or modesty or anything. All right, it is page 199, and I'm going to restart here at the third paragraph. The amber-haired woman laughed at this. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Paragraph 2. This is most amazing to me, my lady, the young thief replied, truly surprised. Surely you are no feline at all. For unless my eyes deceive me, you are one of the most lovely women I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. The amber-haired woman laughed at this. Thank you, ma'am, for your sincere praise. Be aware, however, that I am called Tirup, and I am what you sort call a tiger-ware. Rather than drawing back in fear and revulsion, Gord laughed in return. This amply shows, fair feline, how ignorant I am. I crave your pardon. Well spoken. You have both my pardon and, I hope, my friendship, if you can accept from such a creature as I." Thereafter, the two fell into an animated conversation, from which Geller quietly excused himself. The arrival of Greenleaf and Melf, chatting contentedly, as if they were long-lost kinsmen, signaled an end to the relaxed sunning. After a brief wedding, both called for a conclave over a repast, so the whole party trooped off to the appointed area for their meal, the court of dappled sunlight and pleasant stretching. They were attended by the humanoid catfolk, but were otherwise alone. Terup had left to join others of her kind somewhere else, whether in the great circle, the great circular mansion, or the countryside beyond, Gord was uncertain. After they had broken their fast, Greenleaf spoke to the others. All right, break. We got a little bit. It's circular mansion of the Cat Lord and an outside area. So it's a little more description of the Cat Lord's domain here. But we also get that this woman, Terup, is a tigerware. Now, back in Saga of the Old City, we encountered a wolfware who appeared as to Gord as a naked woman. It's not necessarily signals that the wares are female. The tigerware, wolfware are female. But it was very strange. The illustration, which may, you know, by Clyde Caldwell in Saga of Old City, showed a male wolf turning into a female appearance who sang. Now, she didn't speak the wolfware. And this tigerware may simply, tigers and wolves may be on a different level. They have may have different abilities. The wolfware seemed to be able to sing a charm song, and this tigerware seems to be able to speak perfectly well. So it's something just to look at later on. Is Gygax maybe describing them differently, and maybe they're different from how they're written up. I mean, that was always a common thing in a campaign, was that you really didn't want the players to know every detail about a creature, so you would change things to shake up the players, or just because you wanted to. Gygax was a big proponent of that, big proponent of a DM doing what he wanted with his or her campaign. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 199 and paragraph 3, but let me just say this first. I'll miss this. It's commented that Melf and Curly, Greenleaf, get along very well, but, you know, Curly is a half-elf, and while he might not know Melf, he may even be a relation, for all I know. Now, Curly was up in the Adri Forest, but he was already an experienced druid, so there's really no telling. We don't have Curly's origin story, so we may have a thing that they may just be getting along because they have elven heritage, or they may be getting along because they actually have a heritage that relates to each other, or simply because the two of them are, you know, have characteristics and personalities that get along. But, you know, there's all these possibilities here between Melf and, Melf and Curly Greenleaf. So anyway, I'm going to get back. It's page 199. We're closing in on 200 right here. And it is paragraph 3rd from the bottom. Melf and I have been in conversation regarding the whole matter of our mission, and his own quest as well. The druid looked at Melf, and the fighter mage nodded his head for the half-elven druid to continue. To be brief, he and I both have urgent need to be elsewhere. At the risk of offending our host, I wish to take advantage of Melf's kind offer to transport me with him when he departs. Melf cleared his throat, and when everyone looked his way, the gray elf smiled and said, I will refrain from departing, of course, if you feel that it will jeopardize those who remain here. There is the matter of the item we all seek, however. Gord, what is your opinion? Gord shrugged. My acquaintance with our host is just that, and I cannot hazard a guess. Still, our purpose seems unchanged, and duty demands that we continue with our mission as quickly as possible. I, for one, have no objection to the three of you leaving. I will take my chances. I'm not afraid of consequences, Chirp boomed. Go on. It will be just you two and Lord Geller who stay behind, the warrior wizard said. Biff is going with us, for he must oversee my affairs in my absence and attend to his own further training as well. Greenleaf nodded, adding, As Melf must report to his liege, Morden Kanan, I too must inform superiors of events. It goes against my grain to leave you, but I must do so now. Let us say our farewells now. Geller, Chirk, Gord, friends and comrades all, be blessed. I'll leave word in Chendal at the royal palace itself as to my whereabouts. Until we meet again, the druid finished, embracing each of his friends warmly. You grow old and soft, Geller said with a chuckle as he noted the tears in the druid's eyes. This is not a permanent thing, merely an answer to a call of duty. All soldiers must do the same. Gord found Melf standing beside him, hand extended. The halfling was there likewise. I thank you, as does Biff, for our lives, he said, gripping the young thief's hand. Here is a token of my everlasting esteem. A small scroll of spells to replace the one you use. May you use them to their direct purpose. Everyone laughed at that. And tension broken, the six said their final goodbyes, and it was done. Melf, Greenleaf, and the halfling went off to the Grey Elf's chamber. They would leave from there unseen. The three remaining men decided to move about the place and make themselves evident, attracting attention just in case. Break. So, here we have the departure of Melf. It seems a little strange because they have this incredibly important mission going on. The Deirdre and Oscar left and they're very angry at that. But what, if you look at the storyline, now, Melf knows that Keek and Obmi went off in the one direction and had the artifact, I believe. So I'm really not sure why they would have Chert, Gord, and Geller stay behind. I mean, the artifact has to be the most, seriously, the most important thing in their lives right here. I mean, the threat of empowering us, let alone summoning up Tharaston, should trump everything else. There should be nothing more important, so I'm a little confused right here when they have the knowledge that Gleed did not possess the artifact. Why they are not, and they have the knowledge of the last place that Melf saw Obmi and Keek, and know that they have the artifact. Until they're sure that it's, or they reach a point where they can't go further, I'm really startled at the breaking of the group right here. I don't understand the reasoning when they were so angry at Deirdre and Oscar. I don't understand why they're breaking the group at this point. I mean, what it should be is, in the story, maybe Melf can't transport six people. That would be fine. And then the ones staying behind, forced to stay behind, could regret it. But here, they're staying behind, and I don't understand that. So,
well, Rex Felis did formally request that they await his return.
That is true, but, again, it's simply a situation of time. I don't understand why Gord, Chirp, and Geller would stay behind. You know, they could all just cast the spell and be gone in an instant, or use the magical device. I'm not quite sure what Melf is going to pull out of his hat.
You know, we know Curly could just use the transport via plants and bring them all wherever.
I'm not sure if that would work. Matt, we are not on the prime material plane. So, okay. According to some of the old, first edition AD&D, when you were on a different plane, spells worked in a different way.
Okay.
So, I'm not quite sure, but maybe it could. You know, nothing is quite defined here, and it's just up to Gygax. But I'm really confused. I know... that Gord has some connection to Rex Phyllis that isn't explained yet, and in the backstory that we haven't been told. And Gord may insist that he has to stay for some reason, but it would be breaking his oath to go after this artifact. And it just seems very strange to me, even with Deirdre, that she left.
I really don't think that they're in the oath-breaking stage yet. They're just putting off the quest till he gets back.
I don't know.
They didn't say they're not going to complete their quest.
Well, it is said that Curly is going to leave a message for them in Chendal.
Mm-hmm. Is that the capital of Pyriandi?
Yeah, and it is. It's also at some royal, the royal palace. Yeah, so they're going to go to the royal palace of Pyriandi and Chendal. So I just find it very strange, though, that they're breaking the group up into two and not going immediately, because it seems so they've lost so much time by following the false lead. And it seems like they would be doing everything in their power to make up that time.
Well, we really don't know how time passes here either, though.
Well, we don't. I mean, since it hasn't been mentioned, they do need... They're going... I don't understand. At this point, I think they're just worried that the Rexfliss will keep them there. But... I find it a very strange situation all in all. They have to be assuming that Rex Phyllis wouldn't be on their side, and that they'd be unable to use this spell or device to get out of there for interplanar travel. I do find that the talk, as we're seeing the context here in the story, does not make sense to me, because that has not been explained. If Gygax had gone into some detail about how, they needed to stay there for such and such a reason, or that they thought too much time had passed, and that they'd lost, the second artifact. I mean, you know, Tharizdun will kill everybody, and there'll be no power to stop him. What if he's awoken? And it just seems like you would do anything. That the single most important thing would be getting that second key. Because if they have it, they don't need to have any of the others. You know, if they can, in fact, they don't all want to have it in one place. So if they can take that second key and guard it in reawakening, and if they can keep it out of Uz's hands, it will certainly diminish us people. I mean, you know, he is like the man with a mission all the time. He's the one who knows the situation, all around the realms and such, and I'm really surprised at Geller. All right. I'm going to restart right here, and we have broken into page 200. It is... the last paragraph of page 200. They toured the huge mansion and strolled the gardens and parks in and around the palace for the next 2 hours. All was quiet and nothing untoward and toured occurred. They gave wide berth to the numerous great cats, which were everywhere. Here a leopard lay on a tree limb. There a pair of cheetahs seemed to be racing for sheer sport. Lions, panthers, tigers, jaguars, pumas, smilodons with their saber teeth, and all the sorts of smaller felines as well, from bobcats to jaguarundi to domestic varieties. None so much as sniffed at them. It was as if the men were invisible. "Come, Gord, your friends, too," Terup called as they passed a green. She was with a handful of men and women, males and females, actually, who all appeared to be her brothers or sisters. "We are practicing our skills with human weapons and having all sorts of sports," the tiger wearer called to them. "Come join us." The three men strolled over, and the others of Terup's kind greeted them in cool but polite fashion. There were two males and four other females, all clad as Terup was, in belted tunics of thick cotton. After introductions, the others returned to their contests, fencing, wrestling, jumping, and whatever else seemed to please them. One large male had defeated all his fellows at wrestling. Kirk could not resist. "I will try my skill against you," he said, stepping into the area of flattened grass and removing his jacket and blouse as he did so. Tigerware male was nearly as tall as the giant barbarian, and his whole body was a mass of corded, rippling muscle. "Ah," the fellow laughed, dropping into a crouch. "This will be a good lesson for you," he added, and then he sprang. All the rest watched with fascination. Fast as the tiger in man form was, Chert was ready. A huge hillman caught the tiger where, in a hold, heaved, and the surprised creature sailed through the air. Chert spun to observe his opponent's fall, but there was no thud and whoosh of breath from the force of the throw. The fellow landed on his feet, snarling. "Come on, Rog, show 'em," shouted one of the females in totally human fashion. The tiger wearer needed no encouragement, however, for he was now circling and ready to spring again. The contest went on for some time without either combatant able to gain an advantage. Both Chert and Rog seemed to grow more angry and determined to break the impasse. From springing and circling, the two went to grips, and after much twisting, breaking of holds, and straining, the massive barbarian finally managed to get his opponent in a vice from which Rog could not escape, nor break in any fashion. "Yield," Chert demanded, applying leverage and squeezing with all his force. "Beware, Chert," Gord called suddenly. "He takes tiger form." Chert instantly loosed his hold and was on his feet, reaching for a non-existent weapon, the axe Brule, which was usually at his broad leathern girdle. Meanwhile, the enraged Rog was completing his transformation. From a 250-pound man, he had changed to a tiger of twice that weight, and there was murder in the great cat's baleful eyes. The other tiger wares were hissing, whether encouragement or some other emotion Gord knew not. Without hesitation, the young thief snatched up Church's mighty axe and sent it spinning toward his friend in one smooth motion. Chert! Barbarian caught the weapon without taking his eyes off the tiger, standing poised to bring the great blade arcing to meet any attack. Neither antagonist moved. Suddenly, Terup was between them. "Stop this. Slaughter is not permitted by our master. You know that, Rog. Shame. And you," she spat at Chert. "As a guest, how dare you bear a weapon in such manner?" Rog was growling curses but returning to man form. The barbarian was sheepishly lowering his weapon. "Stupid cubs, little boys, that's what you are," the angry female said, looking disdainfully from one to the other. "You, Rog, were arrogant and couldn't accept an honest defeat at the hands of a mere human, so you resorted to foul play.
That's all.
So, welcome to the after the break with Craig running out on us. I'm going to restart right here on page 202. We are on the fourth paragraph from the end. Stupid cubs, little boys, that's what you are, the angry female said, looking disdainfully from one to the other. You, Rog, were arrogant and couldn't accept an honest defeat at the hands of a mere human, so you resorted to foul play. Rog, now again appearing as a man, flushed and looked away, but there was no escape, for the others were still hissing at him, and the sound was clearly one of disapproval. Rog slunk out of the ring. Tirup turned to Chert again. Would you kill another over a wrestling match? All were on your side, and simply stepping back would have sufficed to end the confrontation. No, you had to show your manliness and bravery, didn't you? Well, think on the result had you used that weapon, and be glad I stopped your stupidity. Now it was Chert's turn to look elsewhere. He shuffled from the beaten circle and tossed Brule casually to rest on the grass again, pretending nothing had happened. You too, Tirup said flatly, will shake hands and apologize to each other. You're going to behave properly and not spoil things for the rest of us. Do it now. Slowly the two brawny males approached. Then, grinning, they shook hands and began apologizing to each other, sharing the camaraderie of males who had been scolded and bullied by a female, a feeling that cut across species to unite them, and the group relaxed and returned to easy mingling. In fact, the whole affair brought them together in better understanding, and soon the three humans and seven tiger waged in all manner of tests.
I think it's interesting. I mean, I find Chert was, of course, in the right. What did he know what the hissing was? And, you know, the Rog turns into a 500-pound tiger, and he's, you know, he's grabbing Chert. Gord sends Brule to defend himself. But in the end, it does turn out here that it was better for Tirup to have scolded both of them, and it makes a comrade out of Rog instead of an enemy. Now, I don't know if that was the idea of Tirup scolding Chert, or whether it was supposed to be the way she really felt. Now, in this entire section of reading here before the break with Craig and Knot, we really don't have much in the way of lore. That was all story, you know, and it was all story about what was just happening right there. We can take, if you ever take characters as a matter of lore, we can take the idea that the tiger wears and such, turn into human form and, you know, try to excel at their various human weapon and using their hands and wrestling and such, so that they are, you know, not just dangerous in their form as tigers. We get a little bit about a very tiny bit about the dimensions of the mansion, nothing specific, just that it's a very large one with the parks and such. But again, there isn't a tremendous amount. Now, we had heard, you know, about Chendal and the royal palace, with Curly meeting them there and such. But no, I think that is all I can really pull out of this section right here. We're still. I'm going to jump back. It is page 203,
I think the contrast between the wolfware in Saga of Old City with these tiger wares in Artifact of Evil is interesting in the way that they differ. Like the one was completely feral, and these are more, you know, more human, at least yeah. than that one was.
Yes, and it strikes me that, you know, if there is a cat lord, is there no canine lord, you know?
Right. Now,
I would think that these may be, in, you know, when you say feral about the wolfware, that may be actually perfectly correct. The wolfware may simply be brought up among a community of wolfwares or even on his or her own, and therefore never learned to speak, maybe only associated with wolves, and is not as experienced at interacting in, you know, some kind of society, especially the advanced kind of society they're showing here among the cat lord. So I don't know if there was an encounter with tiger wares on the earth, they may be just like a feral version of these. They may not even speak.
These are reined in.
Yes, and I don't know their history, but they seem to be brought up in the and living among the cat lord's domain, which again is another plane entirely. And the tiger wares here aren't necessarily going to be the same as the earthly tiger wares. And if the wolf ware had been brought up among, you know, a society
of the wolf lord,
yeah, then I would say there should be some kind of balance. There should be a wolf lord, that yeah,
it's
would
really interesting how Gygax sets that up. I mean, it gives you the potential to have a pocket plane for every creature.
Yes. Now, if you like Terry Pratchett, one of the things that I found very amusing is he has this, he has death, you know, anamorphized. And so death is actually a big skeletal man, and he's very interested in seeing what it is to live life like a human. And then in one of the stories, they introduce the death of rats, which is a rat. That is in like a cowl and carries a scythe and everything, you know, rat skeleton. So, you know, in that way, you know, it's still, you know, he's showing there's like a little death for every kind of species out there. So, it'd be interesting. Yes, you know, there are an infinite amount of possibilities. And, I think Gygax was always very interested in showing that whatever you imagined and wanted in your game was possible. And,
yeah,
and
I like how he opens that up here.
And so we're looking, you know, I mean, we really don't get this. Every once in a while, Dragon Magazine would put out an ecology of, and maybe have a little story combined with it because... you know, it fleshes things out. I was looking back at some of my, I found while cleaning my room, some 20 plus year old conversations that I printed up from the old Grey Talk. And I had started writing various stories back then, and there was a number of complaints because they felt that Greyhawk fiction shouldn't be discussed. It shouldn't be part of, you know, the mailing list back then, which is like the chat right here. And, you know, my argument was that Greyhawk fiction brings life. And certainly if you can look at any bit of fiction and see what it is doing with the lore and to the lore and how it is bringing things to life. Like, the one of the important things about story that we're seeing here is, and it's not to ignore, is that it breathes life. It shows not just things written in like a supplement to talk about, no matter how detailed, you know, like Sargent's work in IVID or FTA, there or even the bare bones stuff from the folio or box set, they're all dry. And what brings things to life is you know, narrative fiction. It's when you see the characters as living people or living creatures. and we see how the setting works. As and when you DM to people, you are bringing the setting to life. I'm not a big fan of storytelling games, but I am a big fan of a DM bringing the game to life in it, not just being a dry thing of mechanics and rolling dice. And Gygax is the perfect example right here. This story has again and again showed how you can take what's happening in the game and make it a lively thing, a thing with lots of description. And if you're not good at description, then pull the description from Gygax and use it. Have a little, you know, bunch of index cards that you can pull up in a situation and read from them if you're not good at coming off with description off the top of your head. So, yeah, you know, this here, it's so interesting. And then we can look back and think about, we can think about other animal lords. We can think about how these tiger wares act, how the wolf ware act, and we're given examples in these stories. And it's what makes reading these and commenting on and pulling out all that we can from them so interesting. For me, at least. All right. And after all that, I've kind of lost my place. I'm on page 203. And, all right.
It just finished scolding.
Yes. All right, I'm going to restart. We have about 8 minutes left. It is time to see if you can best me, Gord. The others are not really skilled swordsmen. Chert's weapon is the axe. Will you use long or short blade? Grinning and feeling confident, Gord eyed the practice swords that were displayed near his comrade. He selected a small blade not too dissimilar from his own short sword, hefted it, found its balance satisfactory, and stood on guard. Ready, he said, his eyes locked on Geller. And I, replied the bard, slowly bringing a long sword up. A rapid exchange of attacks took place. The feints and parries amazed the onlookers, for such swordplay was rare. The typical mode was to slash, chop, and cut with only occasionally and often fortuitous thrusts or parry. Geller had the longer blade, and he was very fast and clever. Gord's short sword was quicker in response, however, held as it was by the young thief. In addition, Gord was so agile and fast on his feet that there was much fencing before either opponent managed to touch the other. The match would go to whoever managed to hit the other 5 times. Geller finally won with a score of 5-4. That was well done, said Gord as he clapped his comrade on the back. His breathing was easy, and only a light sheen of perspiration showed that the young adventurer had been exerting himself. Geller drew a deep breath. For one supposedly skilled in arts other than weapon play, you show remarkable ability. You seem far better than the last time I saw you ply your blade. The bard said almost ruefully as he mopped sweat from his brow with a linen square. You'd have slain me easily enough were the contest actual, Gord replied, passing the whole matter off. Let's wash the grime from these trials from ourselves and find something to eat. I'm famished. That suggestion met with general approval, and everyone went off to refresh themselves. Gord, Chert, and Geller found their clothing clean and ready for wear, it having been seen to by the servants while they had been at sport. They had a surprisingly fine meal in a small, flower-filled atrium. Chert managed to clear every dish of its contents before finally admitting surfeit. Eventually, each went off to his own apartment to doze. Up, lazy bones! It was Tirup, looking lovely in a flowering gown of deep green, peaked out with golden piping. There is a sing about to be held, and you must come. Gord followed and was soon in a high-raftered hall that was filled with felines. Tirup's friends were there in human form, and there were a number of other people. The young thief wasn't certain about the true form of any of them, but they seemed friendly enough when he was introduced. Geller and Chert were there ahead of him, and already in conversation. Chert with his new comrade Rog and a pair of women unknown to Gord, while Geller spoke with several others, including a white-haired man with pale skin and colorless eyes. Lord Lowen the Seneschal. Lowen, this is Master Gord, Terp concluded the introduction. My pleasure, Gord, and do dispense with formalities. Call me Lowen, please. When the young thief inclined his head in acknowledgement, the Seneschal went on. Your associate here, Geller, has told me a little of your adventures and how you came here, and I am eager to hear more. Our liege was in too big a hurry to be elsewhere to give me much information about the unexpected arrival of guests such as yourselves. Gord gave a brief and lucid account of their adventure, omitting all details that pertained to the second key of the artifact of all evil. He was interrupted often, though, by the quick-witted Seneschal, who asked pointed questions, required to explain some detail or other. Geller helped him to manage the virtual interrogation, disguised as it was by polite conversational tone. Lowen seemed altogether too sharp not to detect the gaps in the hole, but he did not ask direct questions about the reason for the party to be where they were, seeming to accept the vague references to political and military matters as sufficient. Now that is a lovely ring, Lowen exclaimed as Gord was describing an encounter with gesture. What? Oh, this Cherisabarrel. It is nothing, Gord said with seeming modesty as he lowered his left arm to remove the ring from sight. Nothing? It is hardly a trantle, the Seneschal said. A cat's eye stone is most prized here, of course, he laughed. That one has an aura of power about it, which is unmistakable to such as myself. May I ask how you came by it? Break. Well, I'm sorry not to dig further, but we're running out of time, and that is quite an important question, which I'm going to save for the next recording.
Excellent.
So we have the cat's eye ring brought up again. We've got a little information about various things here. Now, I was hoping maybe Gord would get into some detail about explaining what had just happened, but they skimmed over that, quite easily. We've met the Seneschal, Lowen. We have Terep as an important character. Rog is now a friend with Chert. We see a little about this gathering, this sing, which leaves me a little worried knowing how cats can sing.
Mm-hmm.
We've covered a lot of page distance in this, but there is life being brought to the storybook. Most of this really is very light on lore, but we are getting an idea of how pleasant a place the Cat Lord's Plain is, and we can reflect on how vile we see us and the, how of evil basking in vileness, and here the good or the neutral, because I'm not sure a fan of the Cat Lord's alignment, which plays a big deal in what Gygax seems to be doing. He really does embrace the alignment system. All right. It's 7:00. And I'm going to call Craig back and kick him out this time for good.
All right. Good night. I'm off to the Palace of Dappled Sunlight and Pleasant Stretch.
All right. Well, see you tomorrow, hopefully, Chris.